Good morning, thanks for coming. We've got Trustee King and Judge Pepper. They're going to talk about the new proposed National Model Chapter 13 plan. I'll let them fill in all the details, but don't get too concerned. We're not talking about an effective date until December 2015. So there's some time to get used to it and get comments in and everything like that. So it's not something that's happening tomorrow, but we want to bring you up to date on what's going on with it and give you the opportunity to comment and to the committee if you'd like to. Next month, June 11th, we've got John Pintar and Todd Kennett, thank you, on the child support and domestic support obligation issues that arise in Chapter 13. So please come on back and hear about those topics. We don't have anything lined up quite yet for July, Ryan?
We're working on it.
We're working on July. Thank you, Ryan Blay, for organizing all the speakers. If you have an idea for a topic or you like to volunteer, we would love to have you. Just talk to Ryan. Again, thanks again to Judge Pepper and Tom King on the Model Chapter 13 National Plan.
Thank you, Judge Kelly. First of all, for those of you who are in remote locations, you'll be relieved to know that while it is warm and spring-like outside, it's 12 degrees in this room in Milwaukee. So be very happy that you are wherever you are, not in this room in Milwaukee. Tom and I thought that for just a couple of minutes, and I'm going to let Tom mention this, before we start on the Chapter 13 plan, as many of you know, we had a Supreme Court decision yesterday that I think was of interest to a lot of you who have done theft by contractor cases and similar type cases.
All you defalcators out there.
All you defalcators out there now know what it was you were doing, apparently. So, Tom, you want to just mention that briefly?
Well, I do want to mention it briefly. I want to thank Dan Freund for posting the item. I see Dan's up there in Eau Claire. I guess the snow piles have receded and they made it in. And it's colder in the hearing room, as Judge Kelly has indicated here, than it is probably outside in Eau Claire today. Yesterday, the Supreme Court came down 9-0 decision, opinion by Judge Breyer. The case is called Bullock versus Bank Champaign, N.A. And it says basically that defalcation is going to require a culpable state of mind requirement, including knowledge that what you're doing is wrong in order to have the non-dischargeability lie. The brief facts on the thing, the elder generation, the father set up a trust, funded it with an insurance policy, and named one of the children as trustee. The beneficiaries were the other children and the one that was the trustee. And the individual made 3 loans from the trust, borrowed the money from the insurance policy at the 6% statute or 6% contractual amount in the policy, and paid them all back with interest. But the money was used to make a profit, and it was self-dealing. And so the other beneficiaries sued and won a judgment that the profits had to be paid back to the trust. And replacing him as trustee, and that's where the bank came from. They were the successor trustee. And then the appellant, Bullock, tried to raise some money to pay off the judgment by selling some of the trust items. Remember, he was a beneficiary for part of it. And the bank resisted. Things got a little tough for him, and he eventually filed bankruptcy, and they objected to the discharge. And the bankruptcy court said no. No discharge of this debt. It was a defalcation. District Court, Court of Appeals agreed, and the Supreme Court went the other way, 9-0, saying you've got to have some culpable action here besides what you had. So.
And I think, as all of us know, for a long time we've been sort of dithering around in this territory without a definition of defalcation. The Seventh Circuit had a decision that sort of hinted or said that at least there needed to be more than just mere negligence. And so in the Seventh Circuit, we had it needs to be more than just uh-oh, but nothing beyond, well, what more than uh-oh do you need to have? So I think we now have whether you like it or not, somewhat more definitive guidance on what defalcation is, and it's a lot more than I think, based on.
Because you used to be a criminal lawyer, so you know what the model penal code standard of recklessness means.
What is that?
Yeah, model penal code standard of recklessness? I have to tell you, in 16 years of practicing criminal law, I never once utilized the model penal code of recklessness.
I mean, that's the problem, right? I mean, it'll be very interesting to see, I think, what the 11th Circuit does with it, because the 11th Circuit had this objective recklessness standard. The court, although they're unanimous as to saying you look to the model penal code, but against a backdrop of probably legal error, it's very unclear to me sort of what that means and how it differs from whatever objective recklessness is. And so, I don't know. I think more lies ahead.
Yeah.
I had one interesting comment in there I want to raise, and that was discussion about the Second Circuit decisions previously by Judges Learned Hand and his little brother Augustus. And Learned Hand said that the term defalcation may have included innocent defaults. And so they distinguish that and say, no, he's wrong. Augustus had it right in In re Bernard, that it requires a known breach of duty and not mere negligence or mistake. So here's one for the younger siblings.
Nobody tell my brothers that are lawyers.
from Learned Kelly.
I do wonder what we're going to do with these theft by contractor cases, though, because they talk about a knowing breach. So if you know about the theft by contractor statute and you pay somebody other than, is it defalcation or not? I'm not sure this cleared it up. I was hoping it would.
Yeah, I mean, we've been operating under a somewhat strict liability standard almost here in Wisconsin, where, the statute requires contractors to segregate the funds and so forth and so on. And the fact that a contractor said, well, I wasn't really clear on that, and I used this to pay that, but eventually it all caught up with itself. I don't know how those are going to fare under this new decision.
Well, and when the bank sweeps the bank account for the contractor, then it makes it impossible for the contractor to pay it. And that sounds like it's dischargeable now.
Yep, because that wasn't the contractor's knowledgeable default. So,
yeah.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit to the actual topic, strange concept though it may be. As many of you know, for a number of years now, there's been talk of the creation of a model, perhaps even mandatory, national Chapter 13 plan. We all know that Chapter 13 is local, 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 and every district does it differently, and sometimes, not here of course, but sometimes even the judges do it differently within a district. We've had a model plan, as we know, for a number of years, and it's been mandatory. Lots of other jurisdictions have their own model plans. There are jurisdictions that don't have model plans. And so in the past few years, the Rules Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States, headed right now by Judge Weedoff, our neighbor to the south in Chicago, has been considering creating a model national Chapter 13 plan. That's a mind-boggling concept when you think about it, if you look at the differences in plans all over the country, not just in plans, but in practice. We all know that there are some districts where you pay the mortgage inside the plan, conduit districts, the trustee pays the mortgage payment, both the post-petition payment and the arrearage. In other districts like ours, that's not what happens. In some districts, you have to file an adversary proceeding to strip a lien. In other districts, you can do it by motion. There are as many variations on Chapter 13 plans probably as there are people in districts. And yet the Rules Committee is considering a model Chapter 13 plan. That Rules Committee is composed in the main of judges. There are a number of bankruptcy judges on it. As I said, Judge Weedoff, who is one of the most respected bankruptcy judges in the country, is the chair of the committee as a whole. Judge Harris from Ohio, Art Harris, is on the committee. Judge Judy Wismer from New Jersey is on the committee. Judge Elizabeth Paris from Oregon is on the committee. She's also the person who's been working on the forms modernization project, which many of you may know about, or some call the forms lengthization program, but creating and modernizing and updating the bankruptcy forms. So all of this is kind of happening at the same time with a lot of input from bankruptcy judges. But the process has now reached the stage where there actually is a draft of this national model plan, and the committee is starting to seek commentary from the outside world. There's already been what Judge Weedoff calls a mini-conference, where they invited trustees, creditors' attorneys, debtors' attorneys, all different parties to sort of weigh in and make comments and critique the document. And Judge Weedoff has been seeking commentary from other bankruptcy judges. Judge Kelly and I were at a conference in New Orleans where he gave a presentation and asked other bankruptcy judges to comment, ask questions, give input. And they're going to be seeking input from the public. And so, as Judge Kelly said, that's why we wanted to share with you a little bit about what the committee is envisioning and looking at. Let me just briefly tell you that Judge Weedoff explained to the bankruptcy judges that the reason the committee is interested in a national model plan, reasons plural, several fold. First of all, it is difficult to get a body of law that is consistent and consistently applicable across the country if each judge who looks at a Chapter 13 plan is interpreting a different plan. So consistency in the law is one precedential value, is one thing that they were looking at. Another thing that they were looking at is that it is difficult for creditors' attorneys to look at a plan in our district and then look at a plan in the Northern District of Illinois and look at a plan in the Southern District of California, because those plans differ, and so they're, of course, hiring local counsel in different places to be familiar with that particular district's plan. This would make it easier for national creditors in particular to be able to review the plan and make some sense of it, easier to make consistent changes across the board. So there are a number of reasons that the committee thought that a national plan might be workable. I will say that Judge Weedoff is an eternal optimist. Anyone who knows him will tell you that he is always hopeful, always enthusiastic, always willing to improve. Some of his colleagues, just to be fair, to give you a fair impression, are perhaps less enthusiastic that this will take hold across the country. But who knows? There have been other things that we've all said, oh my gosh, that'll never work, and then here we are using it. So we shall see. So that's basically what stage the process is in. As Judge Kelly said, if the model plan goes into effect, it would be effective as of December of 2015. And part of that is because there is a specific rulemaking process. Some of you who were at Kohler a few years ago heard Judge Weedoff talk about this rulemaking process, which takes 3 years, basically, to go from inception to finalizing a rule. And there are a number of rules changes that would have to be made to the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure in order to make this model plan workable. So maybe I'll first turn to Tom and let Tom start with some of those rules, and we'll talk through some of the rules. And a lot of these materials are in the outline that Tom very graciously provided.
First, I want to say that we do set out how the rulemaking process does work. We took that right off the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts webpage with the National Mandatory Model Plan information on the rulemaking process. As you heard, it could be in effect as soon as 2015 at the end. It doesn't necessarily have to get there. They could pull this back again. If they take comments through this August and put it forward in August in final form, then it could get through by 2015. They could also pull it back for more comments and come back in another year with another draft after they've got comments and some changes from some of you with regard to this. After it gets through the process and gets put up after the comments, it's still subject to review by the upper level courts on things, and ultimately by the Supreme Court. And then Congress also has a veto on this thing. Now, I've never seen these happen at the higher levels, but this one generates enough heat that perhaps the possibility should be considered.
Well, Congress won't care, but some of the lower levels might care.
Depending on who gets to somebody in Congress, you never know with something like that as well. But anyway, the rules changes. Rule 3002 deals with secured claims right now. We've had a lot of discussion on 3002 and 3002.2 and things of that nature that have gone through. They're proposing to change this drastically. They're proposing that to participate in the Chapter 13, the claim's going to have to be in within 60 days of the petition. And if you don't get your claim in the 60 days of the petition, you aren't going to get it paid in the plan. Now, the lien can still fall through, but provided it's not avoided in the plan, but the lien could flow through if nothing were done in the plan to avoid it and no claim is filed. But if you don't get that claim in within 60 days of the petition, you're going to be out on your ear, unless you're a governmental unit. And they still have their old bar date under this one, so that has been set up in that fashion.
And the purpose of that, obviously, as you know, is to solve this conundrum that we've all been dealing with for a while, which is that as the system is set up right now, you get to confirmation and the claims may not have all come in. You may not know what proofs of claim are out there. Some districts get to confirmation more quickly than others. So as you can see, all these pieces start to feed together. It's not just changing the rules. It's starting to shift the practices of procedures so that they become more similar. If everybody has to file a proof of claim within 60 days, that's going to impact when everybody is getting to confirmation and when all of those claims are going to be considered.
It'll work as long as you don't have the tax claim or the government DSO claim coming mm-hmm. in, because they have a little longer time to get in. And this is the time of the year when I have all kinds of cases that are hung up, waiting on tax claims, waiting on amended plans to pay interest to the secured tax claim as required under Section 511, determining how much of it is secured and how much is priority on the government claims. So from a trustee's perspective, it's not a panacea. It takes care of the mortgage end of things, but not the government claims with regard to these.
The next proposed change will be to Rule 3007, which talks about when and how to serve objections to a claim. Again, this is a problem that we've dealt with for a while, because right now there's not a rule that says when the objection to claim has to come in, so those can come in after the plan is confirmed. Those can come in just about at any point. I think this is one of those changes that is still kind of under development. The committee is still talking about it. They keep talking about trying to find a, quote, unified approach, quote, unquote. I don't know who's going to be unified, but they're attempting to find something. But they're requiring that there be a written objection to a claim, and the objection has to be provided at least 30 days prior to the hearing on which the objection is going to be considered. If it's in connection with plan confirmation, and this is where things get interesting and where I think at our conference that Judge Kelly and I attended, there was a lot of some noise and some hoo-ha. If the objection is related to plan confirmation, the objection has to be heard at least 30 days prior to the confirmation hearing. Well, as you know, here in the Eastern District, we don't have confirmation hearings, and we are not alone. There are other districts that do not have confirmation hearings. So there was a lot of discussion at the conference that Judge Kelly and I attended about, well, is this somehow kind of a de facto requirement that now every district is going to have to have a confirmation hearing? What about those of us who don't? Judge Weedoff seemed to indicate that he didn't think that was the case, although at least from my perspective, and I'd be interested in what you thought, Judge Kelly, I heard before the hearing or at the hearing mentioned about 20 times during his hour and a half long presentation. So there seems to be a lot of assumption in this proposal that there's going to be a confirmation
right.
hearing.
Right, and in Chicago, they do have confirmation hearings, and Judge Weedoff thinks the code and the rules as presently put together requires them. We take a different view. And I specifically asked him, I said, there's a lot of people concerned that now we're going to have these hearings, which when I started here, which is 10 years ago, believe it or not, we did have confirmation hearings, and they were very, it was like almost being in traffic court, where the trustee would read off the names of the cases and say, recommend confirmation, and the judge would say, okay. I mean, they were meaningless. So the idea was, why are we having meaningless hearings? And I specifically asked Judge Weedoff, and he said, no, this would not change. People who interpret the rules to not require confirmation hearings would not have to change. So that was his interpretation, so I felt pretty good about that.
But doesn't hearing mean an opportunity for a hearing if you want one? And we have contested confirmation hearings if somebody objects.
Certainly, if somebody objects.
And if nobody objects, they've had the opportunity, and that's our hearing.
Right.
And that's the definition.
And that's been our interpretation. Right,
right. And we spell that out very clearly in our 341 notice, et cetera, that if you want to object to this plan, you need to file that objection.
Judge Eisenberg used to say that he did have confirmation hearings. He signed the orders of confirmation from his recliner in front of his TV.
And we do watch the time limits for that hearing on confirmation and submitting our orders as a trustee. Both Trustee Grossman and myself are mindful of those time limits when we submit those. And if you get one earlier than that, it means we made a mistake. But we're trying to watch those.
So when we look at the next rule, 3012?
3012 has to do with the treatment of the claim. And currently, you can value the secured claim by motion, and there's no determination of priority claim amount. Now, they're going to have this available in the plan process. And so that can be addressed right through the plan, and creditors should understand that, like our Eastern District plan now, someone can do something to you in a plan, and if you don't object timely, you're going to be out on your ear. And that's basically what we're doing, being extended to the country with regard to treatment of a plan item. And certainly when we do that, we have the local plan that says the plan is going to control on replacement value. And the car creditor says, my car is worth $7,000, and the debtor says it's worth $3,500, and they put that in the plan, give you notice, it's going to be controlling here. That kind of provision is going to go nationally if this goes through.
And following on that is Rule 3015, and there are going to be some pretty significant changes to Rule 3015. I guess all of these are pretty significant, but pretty significant changes. 3015 is going to become, in effect, a rule codifying Espinosa. 3015 is going to, first of all, require a particular kind of service of the plan on creditors. If what Tom is talking about is that if it's in the plan and you don't open your yap, then you snooze, you lose, then the way you get served is going to become important. And I know, you know, there's some practitioners out there already who try to ensure a certain kind of service. 3015 is going to have an amendment in it that, quote, assures, unquote, service on creditors so that those creditors can have an opportunity to object. It's going to establish a default deadline for objections to confirmations. Again, these are tied to this hearing that Judge Weedoff says that we don't have to have, but that's the way the rule is designed. Within 7 days prior to a confirmation hearing, that's the default deadline for filing objections to confirmation. And they're going to back out from that a deadline for sending notice of the plan and notice of the confirmation hearing that we don't have to the creditors so that the creditors are aware of that. There's going to be a section added to 3015 that basically says, according to the Rules Committee, in compliance with Espinosa, that confirmation of the Chapter 13 plan controls over any contrary proof of claim. So as Tom was talking about in 3012, this notion of notifying which one controls, there will be a provision in the model plan and in the rule that says the plan controls once it's confirmed. There'll also be a particular notice required for plan modifications if you're going to modify the plan. So I know that some districts, in response to Espinosa, almost started to require service if you were serving an adversary complaint. This is edging us closer, I think, maybe not quite that far, but closer to that in terms of ensuring service of the plan on a creditor so that the creditor will have the opportunity to object.
Judge, I don't see anything in that rule telling me who gives that notice. Is this going to be left on the clerk or the debtor? You certainly wouldn't want to impose that on the trustee.
Well, and I'm sure that we wouldn't, Tom, and given sequestration, whether you impose it on the clerk or not, the clerk's not going to be able to afford to do it. So I think that leaves us an answer as to who hopefully can afford to do that.
Okay.
I do think this means you can do lien stripping in the plan. All these adversaries that
yes.
we've
I think
been
it's clear.
Can be done in the plan, but you have to serve your plan just like you serve your adversary. In other words, certified mail to Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank and those
depository
correct.
Institutions.
Correct. Correct.
Right.
So,
and we'll get to that in a minute because Rule 7001 is also one of the rules that's going to be modified, and we'll get to that in just a second. But we have Rule 4003.
And that gets us right to Judge Kelly's point. You can avoid liens in the plan under Rule 4003. Notice is going to be enhanced. Lien avoidance on exempt property, 522F, can be done in the plan, not a separate motion, if this goes through in the form that it's in. So there, a good deal of this is all going to be in the plan. It's going to be a change from what we've had here. Some of what we've had here is not available in other districts, but the plan is going to be effectuating a good deal of these changes, whether we're talking lien avoidance, like Judge Kelly referred to, whether we're talking the 522F lien avoidance on the personal property. All can be done within the plan.
The next rule is also going to be something of a change for us. But it follows on to the Rule 3002.1 changes that we've now been living with since a December or so ago. The issue that continues to vary across the country after Rule 3002.1, of course, tells us what creditors need to provide in order to support a motion for relief from stay. But the issue that continues to plague us is, if there's an adversary and the lien is stripped, what's the creature that tells us that that lien is satisfied or that lien is paid off or whatever it is? Some bankruptcy courts say, you know, go to state court and let the state court tell you what is or is not satisfied. Other bankruptcy courts say, okay, I'll deem the lien satisfied. Still other debtors' attorneys attempt to say, well, by default it's satisfied. We're not going to have a rule that says, here's how you get a determination that the lien or the claim is satisfied. Rule 5009 is going to be this new rule, and it relates to closing the case. So it directly connects the satisfaction of a lien to the closing of a case in either 7, 12, or 13 cases. And you can get an order declaring that the lien is satisfied. There's a notice period. The creditor has an opportunity during that period, if it wants to say, no, don't declare it satisfied. But if there is no objection during that 30-day period, then the at the administration and closing of the estate, you can get an order deeming that lien satisfied. And that's a new creature for us.
As we indicated in the outline, though, the language was drafted to talk about closing, left open the question whether you need the discharge
right.
in order to get that satisfaction. And that be something that's still going to be determined by the judge in each of the districts and may be different depending on your location.
And we just had a circuit decision a few days ago.
Fourth mm-hmm. Circuit?
Yes. Fourth Circuit indicating that you could have a Chapter 20 lien strip. So that's the first appellate court that's given us a ruling on that. We'll see if sometime around when all this is swirling, the Supreme Court decides to stick its nose into that territory or not. I don't know. That'll be interesting to see. But we'll just follow up that one really quickly with Rule 7001. As you know, right now 7001 gives us that list of certain sorts of things that need to be dealt with by means of an adversary, and we need to use the 9014 notice procedure. And included in that list is motions to determine the extent, validity, or priority of a lien. It's that language in 7001 that's caused the judges in this district to say, if you want to strip off a lien, you have to do it by means of an adversary, because it's right there in that list. I know there are other districts in which they don't do that. They do it by motion, and you know, that's fine. We've interpreted that rule to tell us that you have to do it by means of an adversary. However, if these changes go through, that rule will change. That provision that says actions to determine the extent, priority, or validity of a lien must be filed by means of an adversary in 7001 will be removed. That will be taken out. So it will be clear that, as Judge Kelly says, you can file a motion to determine the extent or validity, priority of a lien, and you can do it through the plan. But again, the rule will also indicate that you have to provide that enhanced notice so that the creditors have the opportunity to object so that they're not found sleeping on their rights under Espinoza. So that's going to be a change.
I wonder what would happen if you did everything right with this new plan and you're trying to strip off that second lien, but you didn't serve it correctly. Is your whole plan confirmation a problem? I mean, would we hold up confirmation and say, oh no, you didn't use certified mail to strip off Wells Fargo's lien, so I can't confirm your plan? Or if you miss that as the judge or the trustee and you go ahead and approve it, is it binding without that good notice? And what about the rest of the plan?
That's an interesting.
It kind of concerned me. I kind of like that we keep it separate now, and the rest of the creditors don't seem to be affected as we work through these service issues we sometimes get.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, particularly given the fact that, and the second part of your question, Espinoza tells us, you know, if, first of all, Espinoza tells us bankruptcy judges would never miss this, right, because they read every line of every plan.
Absolutely.
But let's assume that one of those non-time-limited bankruptcy judges misses a sentence in your plan, and the plan gets confirmed. Espinoza says, okay, so it got confirmed. Creditor, you didn't open your mouth. I'm not sure how Justice Thomas squares that judge who read every single line with missing a line, but be that as it may.
Well, and if you confirm a plan that avoids a lien upon the closing and then upon the closing of the case, is the order closing the case going to avoid that lien, and how are title companies going to accept that? Is the form closing, it's a form order that just says, you know, any liens provided for avoidance in the plan are void.
Right.
Is that going to do it really to clear title? Because usually you have to have the legal description in order to put that avoidance into the chain of title.
I'm going to hazard a guess here and say, because there's the availability of the order of the court declaring the lien satisfied, that the title company is going to look for the best thing they can get, and they're going to ask for that. That's my guess on how it's going to shake out.
Probably 3 or 4 years after the plan is finished, and now you're trying to sell the property.
Or refinance,
yeah. Now you have to go back to bankruptcy court to get your comfort order.
But if I want to hazard a guess, that's going to be the gold standard for the title company. They can get that bankruptcy court order saying that lien's taken care of. And that's going to be golden for them. There's no exposure at that point.
Well, and a lot of them don't get that now. That's more than they get now. So. The last big rule change, and it's a big one, is Rule 9009. As you know, our model plan says that you can't change the language of the model plan. And if you have anything funky you want to put in there, you have to put it in the special provisions box at the end. I think it's number 10 in our model plan. So for all intents and purposes and pursuant to our local rules, that makes our model plan mandatory. You must use it. Rule 9009 pretty much has the same effect for the national plan. It says that you cannot make changes or modifications to the national plan, that you have to use it as is. It has a special provisions box, and we'll get to the plan in just a minute, and I'm hoping that Tom will sort of walk us through the plan from a trustee's perspective, but there is a special provisions box. But I think the effect of this Rule 9009 is that if this plan goes into effect and this rule is approved, this model plan will be mandatory. There was a great deal of noise from the bankruptcy judges at the conference we attended, including a former Chapter 13 trustee who is now a bankruptcy judge, Judge Brian Lynch, who said, you know, I think this is a great idea. It's a wonderful, you know, I love some of the provisions in this. I think this will be easier for a lot of people in some respects. But even he said, mandatory? You're going to make people use this? I don't know. So I have a feeling that, as Tom said, this proposal, the heat that it's generating is in some part because Rule 9009, if implemented in the form that it's proposed, will make the model plan mandatory.
9009 looks like our paragraph 10 on special provisions. But some of the discussion I've heard with regard to that is you aren't going to be allowed to do as much in paragraph 10 as we do here. So we would not have a situation like we have now, where frequently I've got one office that goes through the 9 paragraphs, and then they put in paragraph 10 any inconsistencies between this paragraph and the prior, this paragraph governs. And sometimes they are very inconsistent. They've been given with one hand and taken back with the other. And I think there's a real due process problem for the creditor who reads in paragraph 5 that we're goring your ox this way, and then something else happens to him in paragraph 10, and the print is even smaller.
And one of the reasons I think that Tom makes this observation is, if you'll take a look, I think we put a copy of the plan in your materials. So if you want to follow along, or if not, you can take a look at it later. But one of the first things that you'll notice about this model plan, and we thought ours was honking long when we created ours, and I know a lot of people said, geez, oh, Pete. Well, take a look at the one here. I mean, this is, if you count, you know, front and back of all these pages, it's 6 pages, this model plan. And then in addition, there can be attachments or exhibits. So one of the reasons I think that the special provisions section of the model plan is not going to allow you to do as much is because this plan is a lot longer and a lot more detailed, and you're going to be more constricted within the body of the plan than you are, I think, in a plan like ours, for good or ill. So, Tom, maybe we could take a look at the form itself and.
All right, we've got the form in your outline. Starting with the form at the beginning, like ours, ours has a checkbox for the special provisions. This one has 4 checkboxes. Indicates if you're going to limit the amount of the secured claim and give a partial payment or no payment, you've got to check that box. You're avoiding judicial liens, you've got a box to check. You're avoiding a non-possessory, non-purchase money security interest, you got a box to check. And then you got the one you're all familiar with from our model plan, the special non-standard provisions in paragraph 10. I think that's probably going to work just fine in terms of notice. I think the word's going to get out to creditors pretty easy if something like this goes through, that the plan can really work over your rights. I think the people in our district understand that already with the change we made. Some of them learned the hard way after the change got implemented when BAPSEPA came through. But all in all, I think there's basic notice there that's going to work fine. Some of the rest of this plan, I think, needs a whole lot of tweaking.
Well, and you may not be alone in that. Let me also comment that those of you who are familiar with the Forms Modernization Project, and some of the model forms that have already come out for comment, know that part of the effort there was to translate those forms into plain English so that people who perhaps were not trained lawyers could understand what the forms said. There's a lot of controversy out there about whether that's a great idea. I mean, we all know that, and not just because we're lawyers, that pro se debtors are at a disadvantage. They don't understand the system. They don't know what their options are. It's very difficult for a pro se debtor to get through the bankruptcy process, particularly the Chapter 13 process. It's a nightmare. I, for one, have never, ever had a plan complete with a pro se debtor in the 8 years I've been here. you'll notice that this plan has that same sort of effort in it, the sort of plain English explanations of terms. You should read these papers carefully, talk to your attorney about them. If you have an attorney, it's supposed to be in plain English. Part two, on the front page of the plan, I think probably is going to look pretty familiar to everybody as well. It's pretty similar to what we do. It's a plug and play for how many, you know, what your payments are going to be, whether they're going to be paid monthly. Right now it just says by month, but I think I've seen at least one suggestion that it be you give the option of monthly, biweekly, weekly, because, you know, the people get paid in different ways.
Judge, why couldn't this plan be set up such a way, since most of the people with the lawyers are using the software now, where they just put in the one provision that they are electing on these? And so therefore, if you have a number of choices for plan payments and length of plan, you could have a laundry list, and you just plug in the one that you have in that place.
That's a good suggestion, and that's a reminder. That's another reason that this proposal of a national plan and a mandatory national plan is being made, is because the software companies then could provide more options instead of having to worry about what's required in each district. Software allegedly would work better for all of you if there was one plan. So that may be a good suggestion.
Certainly with the plan payments and length of plans, we have things, the tax refunds are different in every district we're in.
Right.
The periodic payments are different. There's no special adjustments that you can make, and you really want that in that section rather than paragraph 10, where you're talking about plan payments. In our district, we regularly have a step up when the 401k loan is paid off. We have teachers that don't get paid in the summer and have a summer skip provision. We have people that have a kid leaving the house, and thankfully, not only do they leave the house, but they are become self-supporting, and the debtor has more income available for the plan. So these kind of things occur on occasion, and I think the plan payment provisions on part one should allow that, and this plan really doesn't, and some of the trustees have been very critical of that on our trustee list.
And those are the kinds of comments that people ought to be, whether you agree with Tom or not, ought to be making to the committee as the public comment process goes along, because I know they're paying attention to those comments, whether they take them under advisement and utilize them or not. They are considering the public comments. Part three?
Part two yet. While we're still on part two, what are we supposed to do with those? I understand the provision for proposed monthly plan payments. Occasionally, a debtor may miss a payment or may make a short payment. Probably not any of your clients would ever do that, but it does happen. What do we do? Do we prorate these? Is somebody ahead of somebody else? Frequently, debtors' counsel want to make sure one payment gets made, come hell or high water, and we'll abate on the other one. Mortgage companies can usually wait because their property was holding value until the last couple of years. Now maybe not so much with the mortgage company. The car company is going to be in a lift to stay real quick if they aren't getting paid, though. So something that gives us a ranking would be of some help there with regard to that part two.
That is a good suggestion, and you'll also note that part two, I think, is designed, obviously it's not just for the mortgage payments, but any kind of secured debt is going to fall into that same category. You'll see subsection 9 under there. There's your avoidance of judicial liens through the plan, and there's a great deal of detail being provided on, I guess it's the second page that covers section 9. They're asking for a great deal of the amount of lien not avoided and paid as secured claim, and then there are all these different options that are given there to break it down, the amount of the lien, what other liens there are, the exemptions are listed in there. You do this whole mathematical calculation that looks vaguely like the B-22 form to get to that point. Ryan?
Going back to number 7 real quick, the last full sentence talks about the holder being allowed to secure the claim other than Part 2, Section 6, retain the lien until the earlier payment on the debt or discharge. So if a lien is being avoided through the plan or through
whatever procedure is going to go into effect, there has to be a discharge in order to finalize it?
Well, unless it's paid off. Ryan's question is that under Section 7, under Paragraph 7, there's language in the last sentence that says that the lien retention lasts either through payoff or discharge. So if it's not paid off, does that mean the only way to get the lien avoided is through a discharge? That's an interesting question, because that's what it seems to imply. That's at least what the language seems to imply.
Would that overrule the Fourth Circuit decision, then?
Would that overrule the Fourth Circuit decision?
No. The section on dismissal says that liens spring back. So even if the lien was paid off and the case was dismissed before discharge, then the lien's going to come back, even though it's...
But this is saying if it isn't dismissed,
right,
it gets all the way...
That's what it's saying. You can avoid it, and that seems to conflict with the statute.
Well, right. That's the point, is that what happens to those cases where you complete it, but you don't get the discharge? And the answer is, don't know.
Well, if you complete the plan and aren't entitled to a discharge, then maybe you'll get the lien avoidance anyway.
Anything else?
You've got to be the holder of an allowed secured claim, it says. If you read the whole thing, this is only for, you know, say you had an investment property, so you stripped it down to $5,000 and paid it off. That would take the discharge or full payment to get rid of the rest of the lien over the $5,000.
Yeah.
But if you're completely stripping it, as I read this, that is not an allowed secured claim anymore. Therefore, it goes in with the unsecured claims, and that lien is going to go away on closing of the case.
So your allowed secured claim is effectively zero, and it's paid off through the plan, and you don't need a discharge?
Right. Something like that. If you read that whole seven, mm-hmm, I think that's what they're suggesting, that if you're completely stripping the lien, it's not an allowed secured claim, which makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's no security there for it to attach to.
Mm-hmm.
So then you don't have to worry about it, the discharge coming in. But if it's partially secured, like you could have with a non-residential, maybe that's what
right,
they're trying to get at.
Anything else on part two? Okay. Administrative and priority claims.
Part three. There's language there on the trustee fees. Fees are estimated to be X percent of plan payments, and they're estimated to total. All well and good, but understand those fees can go up or down over the life of the plan. Debtors are always complaining about trustee fees, especially when they see the trustee fee that's set to hit our surplus number in September, and then they complain that the trustee fee has gone up. We are at historic lows on trustee fees in this district. I'm guessing if filing rates go down, which they will someday, that the trustee fee will go up. And confirming a plan with an estimated fee of where it is today is not necessarily guaranteeing that fee for the life of the plan. And this form seems to hold out the promise of something different. I understand why you're looking at the percentage fee. You want to know what the number you're going to use for purposes of determining feasibility. You're estimating what the trustee fee is. You're estimating what your income is going to be and what you can pay too. But I got concerns with the way they put that together. It almost looks like a guarantee.
There's also the Section 13 attorney's fees, and it seems to indicate that all fees will be paid post-petition, because it says in the amount of fill in the blank will be paid in full without interest. Now, perhaps that means that if you got $500 pre-petition and you've got $3,000 left or whatever, you just put the $3,000 in there, I don't know. But that's an interesting question as to whether it acknowledges pre-petition, post-petition payments on attorney's fees.
A couple of provisions in there. Priority debt that's not paid in full. Remember, you got that 507A1B claim where you can have a priority claim that's not paid but does survive discharge. And there is the rare exception where interest gets paid on the priority claims, where the best interest would require 100% plan at the outset in a hypothetical 7. So they do provide for that as well.
T-
Talk about domestic support obligations paid less than full amount. Why do you think those are being carved out?
I don't know, but...
Well, you don't have to pay government DSOs in full. You have the applicable commitment period of 5 years.
So this is just designed to separately classify the government DSOs as opposed to the regular...
Well, I think.
Those are the only priority claims that you can't...
Right.
That you have
right.
to...
Right. But with the consent of the payee, you could pay...
Because
like a custodial parent,
one
not
of the
in
issues,
full.
Yeah, one of the issues that came up in New Orleans was the... If you phrase things in a certain way, even if it's not allowed in all cases, people will assume that they're being given the option to do something because the language seems to indicate that they're being given the option to do something. And so there were questions about various provisions here. Is phrasing it this way going to make some people think, oh, well, I can not pay my DSO in the full amount regardless of where it's coming from, so I'll just elect not to pay this one? And there was a lot of discussion back and forth about how to phrase things so that people would not think they were being granted rights or abilities in here that perhaps they weren't being granted.
We have the same problem with the payroll order language, where
right.
it says the debtor has consented to a payroll order on there. I don't think that's the law here. The debtor doesn't have that choice.
And one of the boxes that you may have seen back when it says, how's the debtor going to make the payments, there's a box on there that says the debtor will make the payments via a payroll order. And I heard one person ask a question, said, we don't allow payroll orders in our district. So if they see this box here, are they going to think now that they have a right to do something in our district that we don't do? Non-priority unsecured claims. Anything interesting there, or irritating, or worrisome?
Irritating. It allows the cure and maintenance on long-term obligations. That usually, to me, means the student loan and the trust decision that continues to grade on the trustee, but separate class is available, and that does provide that.
It does.
And again, there's a line for the interest in the event the best interest test does require it.
I think executory contracts and unexpired leases is relatively straightforward. You just list them and list what the payments are. And then Part 6 lists very specifically something I think that our plan doesn't do, order of distribution in specific terms and summary of plan disbursements in specific terms. Tom, you want to talk about those?
Well, the order of distribution isn't all that useful for us. It gives an order and a ranking, but it doesn't provide for how much, how often. I mean, we have debtors' counsel now that put in the attorney fees get paid first. That usually draws an objection from the car company, and some kind of deal has to be cut unless something is done there. I think you're going to want something different in terms of prorating any shortfalls and when you do something with that as well. The summary of planned disbursements is even worse.
Mary, I'm sorry.
And there's another problem with the disbursement scheme, that if you have fixed monthly payments, it's entirely possible and often happens that you're paying the secured creditors with fixed monthly payments at the same time you're paying unsecureds.
Mary Grossman points out that what this doesn't seem to envision is circumstances in which you may be paying the secured creditors at the same time, simultaneously, that you're making distributions to unsecured rather than in a set order. This seems to envision that one has to come first.
And we do have some creditors that are insistent that they get paid not as fast as you can pay them, but rather in equal monthly payments over 60 months. And
yes,
those payments are
a number of them, actually.
And they are entitled to that under the statute as amended in 2005. So, as you know, a rule cannot trump a statute. And if there's a conflict, the statute wins. So that's where we're at. Summary of plan disbursements. I wanted to really lay into this is really something that's supposed
to have an opinion.
That is supposed to determine feasibility. And this is something that the debtor's counsel is to put together at the time of filing. They don't have the government claims. They have an estimate as to the mortgage claim, and they're going to plunk this thing in. I think it's next to worthless. If the debtors council wants to run this on their own, great, but bear in mind, this is going to change, and it's going to be of limited utility to all concerned.
Yeah, how much of this are you going to know within 14 days after the date that you file your petition, right?
I think that's correct. Governmental units, as we indicated, the claims bar date for governmental units is going to stay where it is. 60 days from the petition for everybody else, but the governmental unit has 180 from the petition, so it's going to be post-confirmation for many of these cases, or maybe confirmation is going to be held up if we have some indication that we have an issue with the government claim. There's a line for vesting.
Pretty similar to
pretty much what we have now. The non-standard provisions, I don't know what they're going to allow in there, but I'm hearing comments that non-standard provisions are going to be much more limited than what we allow, and that there's going to be difficulties with doing that.
Well, and the question about non-standard provisions also, I think, rolls back around to, if you see a box in here, is it implying to you that you have a right to do something that perhaps in your district would be non-standard? For example, if you go back to Part 4 or Part 3, but I'm looking particularly at Part 4, Number 17, Cure and Default Maintenance Payments, there are boxes under there. Current installment payment, that's the post-petition going forward installment payment. It lists a dollar amount, and then it says dispersed by, and you get to pick a box, trustee or debtor. Now, you know, if we're talking the secured claim and the mortgage, we know that in our district, you don't have the option of checking the trustee box because those payments are made directly by the debtor.
You can. It's just not.
Well, it's not our routine practice.
We do have that option.
And will be objected to by the
trustee. So,
I don't know. I've had some.
No, we do have that option in this district, and there are some debtors, council, who do put in for direct payments on the mortgage.
Right.
It is not required in this district, and we don't compel them to do that, but some do elect that option. And I think Judge Kelly's got most of them, because they're coming from, what it is people up north of Green Bay who don't want to go to two hearings.
Yeah, because I was in Milwaukee, we don't see those frequently, and in Milwaukee we have the flip side, the car payment is made through the plan. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is, whether you're in our district or any other, and you see those two boxes there, one of the big questions that was asked of Judge Weedoff is the implication that either of those options is fine and I may elect either. Now, clearly this plan was designed to be functional in either sort of district, but the reality is if you give this form to somebody and say, look, here are your options, the implication is you can pick either one. That's fine. And several of the judges said, well, wait a minute. So then they picked the option that we don't let them pick in our district. Isn't this misleading?
One of the suggestions that came from any number of trustees is to have a paragraph that relates to local issues for the particular district. And that paragraph would have the common number around the country. And these are local issues that come in. And the creditor would know they'd have to look at that box and 10. Knowing that there are things that affect them. And if there are creditors who regularly appear in this district, they'll get very familiar with this. We have, you know, the representative for Chrysler is in St. Louis. The representative for Ford is in the Twin Cities. They're familiar with our district, and if we have something in a separate paragraph for the district, they'd get adequate notice, and they'd soon develop an appreciation and an understanding. Creditors who do not appear in the district regularly will get used to the idea that if there's a box for the particular district, they would look at that box as well as the box 10 and decide what they have to do.
And, of course, the opposing argument is, then why are we going
why
through
are we
all
doing
this?
A national plan? Keep our local district.
Right. Marietta?
I don't see any discussion in here about adequate protection payments made by trustees, and I think that's pretty common. Was there any discussion?
There wasn't where we were. I don't think anybody asked about it, and I didn't even notice that.
And the plan does not provide any provision for adequate protection by the trustee. And obviously, this is something that has been very useful for us here in this district, very useful to the trustees, very useful to debtors' counsel in avoiding lift stay motions.
Thanks so much to the members.
Bibles for John Pintar and Todd Pinnock on child support and DSOs in Chapter 13. Thanks a lot for coming. Make sure to sign up for your COE and send your email to Paula to get your COE credit. Thank you.